Welcome to the Found Symbol. We are three actual Freemasons, and we're going to discuss all the symbols, signs, and Easter eggs in episode 4, La Font Orientation, of Dan Brown's The Lost Symbol. Right. I'm John, and I'm here with Jason and Joe tonight. And as always, fair warning, there will be spoilers ahead of episode 4 of Dan Brown's The Lost Symbol. What'd you guys think of this week's episode? Cool.
It was good.
Yeah.
It was good. Like, the one main gripe I have with the show right now is that they packed so much symbolism into the first episode that it set the expectation for each subsequent episode to carry the same level of symbolic complexity. And I'm just not seeing anything now we're into episode 4 that rivals episode 1.
It was a lot. It was a lot in the beginning. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, that's a relatively minor gripe at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yep, how about you, Joe?
I liked it. It had more action, and they brought back the security guard dude. He's back in the mix. I like him. He's cool, doing his thing. But definitely light on the sim. And they brought up similar symbols that they've had in the past, and I don't know where they're going with them, but we'll talk about that in more detail. And
falsely attributed them to Masonry again.
Again. So let's get right into the symbols then. So this week, one thing that I didn't bring up yet, because it is kind of like, if you've read the book, it is a critical symbol that comes up throughout into the final end of Moloch, which is the that little dot that goes inside the O in the lost symbol, or the also known as the circumpunct. And in this episode, even, again, because when you look for that target-looking symbol, you're going to see it everywhere. And I saw it right in the very beginning of the episode where the lady went into the coffee bar, and there was a bright neon set of concentric rings. And it was just right there for the viewing. They didn't try to hide it. Yes, it was not just a dot with a circle around it, but the circumpunct itself is a pretty powerful symbol. It's one of my favorite symbols in Freemasonry. It is a Masonic symbol that has allusions to alchemy, to the sun, and to deity itself. And so it's a pretty powerful symbol, which is why Moloch, spoiler, will use this later on as he finishes tattooing himself. But so it's good to see that it's in there.
You don't know that?
I mean,
you don't,
yeah,
you don't
totally
know that.
Well, the way they've been departing from the book, I don't know. Who knows where they're going to go with it?
I bet you it's the next symbol we're going to talk about, which will really piss me off.
Right. Well, and the one thing that is interesting is not only do they have this as, the bump in the the title sequence, but they also have it in some of the posters that they've made for some of the different characters. They actually have Moloch, and his symbol behind him is the circumpunct, this point within a circle. So I think, that is another allusion that they're going to actually use that as a MacGuffin to carry the story along. All right.
Gotta have those MacGuffins.
But then, as you guys were mentioning, we did have this callback to this Triskelion. What is this? Why are they talking about this?
So we've talked about this ad nauseum, I think almost every other episode.
Every single episode.
So far.
So just to give you a different person to tell you what it is. So the Triskelion, to all of our knowledge, but Jason, John, and myself, we're not part of the Leviathan group, so we don't know. It's not Masonic. It is definitely a symbol that goes back to antiquity. It goes as far back as the fifth millennium BCE. Shows up in Malta, shows up in Newgrange, shows up in pre-Hellenized Greece. way before you get the Triskel that Jason talked about.
Ancient Ireland.
It was a Celtic symbol. And then here in this episode, they talked about it as referencing a Masonic concept of life, death, and rebirth. But that's not really what it means in most other cultures that have used it. You know, there is a triune nature that gets talked about. You know, I think the most notable one is the Celtic one, where it talks about the physical, the celestial, and the spiritual. But it's a really big stretch. Again, unless Dan Brown knows more than we do, or Peacock knows more than we do.
Quite possible.
They're part of the Leviathan group. And not Masonic. But
I'm going to
put a dollar. We're not a high enough level yet in Masonic.
I'm going to bet a dollar right now that that's the tattoo that he puts in the top of his bald little head.
Oh, the bets are on. All right. So what are you thinking? Put your ideas in the comments. So let's see. We have a little bit of progression where Robert Langdon meets up with Peter Solomon's Masonic friend in a public square. And I'm drawn to Bellamy. This. Bellamy, thank you. Drawn to this. Oh, crap. This. Let me get my slides up here. Drawn to this diagram or this statue very quickly, right? They do some excellent framing. And before they even describe this character, the first thing I see is the placement of the arms. Because if you've read the book that they don't include into the show, they talk about the apotheosis of George Washington, right? Where he's trying to do the as above, so below, kind of showing the separation of the celestial and the terrestrial. So that alone got my interest. And then to find out that they're actually talking about a certain Mason in the statue. And who's that Mason? Joe?
That is Teddy Roosevelt. Was a Freemason. And they brought up one of the coolest stories that I know of about Theodore Roosevelt. It was when he was giving a speech, I think on the presidential campaign. And he got shot in the chest. And instead of going to the hospital like a normal person does, he actually got up on stage, finished his speech, and then went to get medical care. So, Teddy Roosevelt, the bad, hardcore dude. But
take more than a bullet to stop the bull moose.
Indeed. But this statue shows up on Roosevelt Island, which is in our area. It's a small little island in the Potomac. And I guess we could see the as above, so below symbology there. But that statue itself is it's in the main grove in Roosevelt Island. It's a 17-foot tall bronze statue. And I did find some information about it. It was sculpted by someone named Paul Manship. And it expresses Roosevelt's philosophy on manhood, youth, nature, and the nation. So a little bit of masonry there.
Nice.
Hardcore dude.
Awesome. And then we do a little digging and we find out the connection to the title of this episode, which is the person in the name of Major Peter Charles L'Enfant. So who was L'Enfant?
So Pierre Charles L'Enfant was a French-American military engineer who designed the basic plan for Washington, D.C., it's known today as the L'Enfant Plan, which was designed in 1791. And so L'Enfant was recruited to serve in the Revolutionary War to assist the colonies in the war effort. He arrived in 1777 at the age of 23, and he served as a military engineer in the Continental Army with Major General Lafayette, another Freemason. And so following the American Revolutionary War, L'Enfant became known as a civil engineer. He ended up establishing a civil engineering firm in New York City and ended up achieving some notoriety by redesigning City Hall in New York for the first Congress of the United States. And so meanwhile, fellow Freemason President Washington appointed L'Enfant in 1791 to plan the new federal city, which we of course know now as Washington, D.C. And even though the United States Congress paid him for his work on the Washington, D.C. design, L'Enfant died in poverty in 1825. And the interesting thing that I've found is that the lost symbol gets it spot on as far as what L'Enfant left behind. He left behind three watches, three compasses, some books, some maps, and surveying instruments with a total value of $46.
Wow, they nailed it.
They nailed it. So we do have records that L'Enfant was a Mason. He was proposed for membership in Holland Lodge in New York, elected to membership on the 3rd of April, 1789. And so it was 2 years before Washington appointed him to plan out Washington, D.C.
And one thing I found fascinating just about the history of L'Enfant is that his plans never got made exactly the way he wanted. And so I can imagine how frustrating that would be, as an architect, where you're trying to deliberately design things a certain way, even Masonically inspired or not. And yet, when you hire to contractors, they screw things up. So so it never got to be truly in the layout that he wanted. So all the conspiracy theorists talking about, look at all the Masonic symbolism hidden in the streets of Washington, D.C., well, they probably weren't even, there because of how they screwed it up over the years, based off the plans.
Even if L'Enfant, wrote it into the original plans, it
didn't make it.
Secret designs. Mm-hmm.
And so then, in order to discover where her dad's whereabouts are, we have research into a little CIA program known as Project Stargate, also known as remote viewing, brought up as a device in this episode. So is there any Masonic connection there?
Not really. So remote viewing is an occult practice of, trying to view things out of your eye line, like out of range of your vision, the practice of seeking impressions from a distant or unseen target, and really purportedly sensing with the mind. And so remote viewing became very popular of a topic in the 1990s when the Stargate Project, 20 million dollar research program that had started in 1975, was declassified and released. So the U.S. government sponsored the program in an attempt to determine, any potential military application of psychic phenomena. You think about like The Men Who Stare at Goats, that movie. Very much, a similar vein, even though I think that movie was about MK Ultra, as opposed to Stargate. But the program was terminated in 1995 after it failed to produce any actionable intelligence information. So if you think about it, the U.S. government spent 20 years trying to gain information and almost like weaponize psychic powers and remote vision.
Right. Yes, I mean, it's interesting because I think the official declaration is that it was inconclusive, right? So they didn't debunk anything. They didn't say it had no value. It was just inconclusive, which again, over 20 years of study, to say something's inconclusive, not bad, right? I mean, so I think in most, most efforts, right, you want to be better than a coin flip. You want to be over 50%. And so to use this as a tool that at times can be spot on and at times can be way off is still fascinating. No Masonic connection overtly, but for those who are interested in using your full abilities, then certainly that falls in that camp. Pretty cool.
So the question, I keep going back to the movie Ghostbusters. in the beginning of the movie, you have Peter Venkman doing an experiment with two folks who are hooked up to electrodes. And he's got a deck of cards. Yes. And he's like, what's on the card? And that's the same type of, you know, that's that same aspect.
Right.
There's the remote viewing. And I think it's just interesting. Like, you know, when John, you talk about, well, it's inconclusive. It's not, you know, completely proven false. You know, my question is like, how many of the right answers were coincidental?
Right.
Or well, other unexplained phenomena.
Yeah.
You know, different from remote viewing.
Yeah. Again, I think that in general, this is a huge blanket statement. When you study kind of like phenomenon that is really hard to quantify, right? That anytime that you are over 50%, like I said, over a coin flip, it has some significance in being able to rely on it, right? Obviously not a lot, not as great as 99%, 100%. But if it's better than 50%, then it's worth looking into. And so I think that's again why it stuck around for so long.
Well, the dude on the episode was like 110% spot on, because
I don't like his portrayal. I will say that his portrayal was like all in the medium sense. Yeah,
auto drawing and all that stuff, and you know, drew an owl and a stone hand.
It was a little dramatic.
It was fun. That was amazing.
I wish I had his abilities. Yes,
wish I had his hair.
But I'm not at that level yet. So we talked a little bit about LaFont's artifacts found on his person at his death. But I did want to highlight one thing that also came up, was that when Robert Langdon showed the map to Solomon's friend, drawing a blank on the name again.
Paul Bellum.
That's it, Paul Bellum. He showed him the square over there in the upper corner of the map. And immediately, you know, as a Mason would recognize the Masonic square. And yet he quoted similarly a phrase that says, "Ye who are engaged in the pursuit of wisdom must also make use of the compass and the square." And I said, I know I've heard that before. I know I've heard that before. Went to Dr. Google and found the source of that quote, which was what my inklings were correct, that it is not inherently Masonic in the sense of that quote coming from a directly Masonic source. It actually comes from about a couple millennia before organized Freemasonry. It actually comes from the philosopher Mencius in China, who lived, let's see, about 300 years before Christ. So we have a couple of his writings in the Book of Mencius, and he has four books, one of which is on, you know, all philosophy and wisdom. And in book four, he talks about a master mason in teaching apprentices makes use of the compass and the square. Ye who are engaged in the pursuit of wisdom must also make use of the compass and the square. Way before organized either operative or speculative Freemasonry. So you know, I find it as an interesting symbol that, of course, we could argue it transcends time and all that cool stuff. And yet, why does he mention it not only there, but multiple times throughout his philosophy, this compass and square union together as a set of tools, what they mean and how applied philosophically. So it is a quote that does show up in Masonic circles and, of course, definitely applies as Robert Langdon correctly identified, a symbol of morality that we talk about. And so, so they got that right. They got that right from a Masonic perspective, kind of what it was for. And then, of course, they used it to draw some really cool lines across these maps and, you know, go all national treasure on it.
John, what was the date for that quote again?
I believe it was, let's see. The Book of Mencius was published 300 years before Christ, 300 BC.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so quite a bit.
That definitely predates operative guild masonry.
Yeah, right?
That we know of, yes.
Right, but he couldn't have just come up with that. So that's fascinating. That's a research topic in itself. And then go ahead,
so Joe. Which of Mencius's books was called The Leviathan Group?
I didn't see that in the four that were published. Yeah. So, no. But one of them did have the Leviathan cross on there. So.
Any Triskelions?
And a few Triskelions for decoration.
Oh, good. You need those.
For the folks who are watching this, like, the last two statements were not factual. They're being sarcastic.
Proven to be a lie.
Okay, moving on.
So the last major symbol found in here, had to adjust the brightness a bit because if you blinked, you would have missed it. Inside the box where the cornerstone or the capstone was found, we have this really cool thing. It looks like an inverted triangle, maybe a pyramid. And wait, there's an eye inside of it. This is a symbol, obviously Illuminati confirmed. Here it is. The Eye of Providence, right? There's Joe. Joe's got his Illuminati symbol up. There's Jason's got the Eye of Providence. Yeah, so the all-seeing eye or the Eye of Providence is a Masonic symbol that does have some reference. Now, you normally, I'll say normally because there's always exceptions to the rule, don't see that in a pyramid for a Masonic context. The eye stands alone. Because it really is a symbol that has predated masonry by, I don't know, I think it goes back to even like early Renaissance type. So let's argue at least, 400 years, probably in the Renaissance era, where Christian paintings were used. A lot of the iconography there, they put the Eye of Providence, the Eye of God, inside of this triangle to actually talk about the Trinity, right? The Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. So that symbol, although you may see it on the dollar bill, you may see it in other Illuminati type concepts. The Illuminati were not the first. The Masons weren't the first to use it. But Joe definitely embodies it every day.
Illuminati confirmed. I live it.
Right. So those are all the major icons, Easter eggs, symbols, and signs that we found in this week's episode. I'm sure there are more. If you found more, please comment below. We'd love to hear what we missed. And, for that, that's all we have for this week. So if you want to see more content on the signs and symbols of Freemasonry in general, subscribe to this channel, the Masonic Roundtable, and we will see you next week. See ya.